We've been dreaming about a perfect kitchen, but where do we even start?
The Creative Kitchen Company. We're your complete design build company for custom kitchens and bathrooms. From initial planning to installation, we'll help you realize your vision.
And no surprise fees or endless upselling?
Never. We provide realistic upfront costs and clear communication through our mobile app so you can track every detail. Don't just settle for any kitchen or bathroom. Call us today at 614-971-3448 for a free in-home consultation or visit thecreativekitchenco.com.
What's going on, everybody? Welcome to On Screen Live special 2024 Toronto International Film Festival coverage. My name is Andrew Jupin. This is part two of two. So this is the final update. Hope y'all are doing good. Thanks for tuning in live if you are on this not normal day that we do On Screen Live. Of course, it's apparently Thursday at noon. Kind of hard to believe that. Yes, normally On Screen Live happening Mondays at noon. We will be getting to our regularly scheduled on-screen live programming, I think a little later this month. We got some more film festival stuff to get through with New York coming up in just a few short weeks. But regular OSL coming back real soon. But before that, let's get to the rest of the stuff we caught at TIFF. Going to bring in my film festival brother, Mr. Chris Cabot.
Hello. Hello, yeah. Everybody. Hi.
Yeah. Working on your night, Chris.
I guess I had, just because of the wording, I suppose, I sure. had the movie I liked probably the least of everything we saw had to become my title. I don't know why.
Well,
on Becoming a Guinea Cabin did not sound like a good idea to me. I'm going to be honest with you. That seems like a bad move.
No, that doesn't work. But also, you can do Night Chris because you have a monosyllabic name.
That's
Night true. Andrew. That doesn't really.
Yeah, Night Drew. You could do Night Drew.
Oh, Night Drew could work. Yeah, I'd still do the Bob Seger working on my Night Drew. Yeah, all right. All right. I like that.
We were doing that for longer than we should have with Jamie and Josh from Sleazoids.
Yes.
Singing different verses of Night Bitch.
Yep.
Two Night Moves.
I have to say, it was really fun getting to hang with those guys. The cool thing about some of these film festivals like this, running into folks like that, and like you're seeing movies together, but you're fucking having a nosh afterwards. You're getting some cocktails. Josh Lewis took us to this amazing Thai restaurant.
Really good.
Right near the festival village that I'd never heard about before. All, get this, folks at home, all the cocktails on their cocktail list, Clint Eastwood movie titles, or I believe characters.
Some of
the names were. Yeah. Pretty cool, I have to say. And tasty stuff, too. I had a Letters from Iwo Jima, if you can even believe it.
The 1517 to Paris was good. Me and Josh and his friend Matt, I had that. And then, forget what Jamie. Jamie had something. I forget.
Yeah, I don't remember. But it was awkward being like, one Letters from Iwo Jima, please.
Yeah. I don't know why. They should do like Honky Tonk Man and stuff like that. They should get some like
exactly
some bar like do a shot and beer special and call it Honky Tonk Man.
If you got like a big bucket of bad beer, it could be the Any Which Way You Can.
Yeah.
And you pick which beer cans, you know.
Yeah, that would work.
See, we could run that fucking restaurant. Right. Anyway, we are here to give our final, I think I'm counting it right now, Chris Cabin, 10 reviews.
That seems right.
I left out a couple of things that I saw that kind of way too small profile, things I might wind up talking about later if they see release.
Sure.
So just to sort of like consolidate this a little bit. But I looked at it and it appears as if on this last run of titles here, Night Bitch is the only thing the both of us saw on this list. So we'll do that last, but we'll go through like we did last time. And folks, by the way, if you didn't catch the first part of this, it's on here on our YouTube channel, which, by the way, like and subscribe to the channel. Got to do that. Like this video, subscribe to the channel, hit that notification bell so you know when we go live in the middle of the day on an off day with only, I think I did one or two social media posts about it. You know that we're going live. Mm-hmm. So anyway, so I think what we're going to do we'll just go one, you know, back and forth like we did a little like tennis, like the U.S. Open was going on. So, you know, this is our movie tennis. Mm. But first up, it's you, my friend. You were talking about the new one from Mr. Sean Baker. That is Anora.
Yeah. The one that won. It's the Palme d'Or. The Palme d'Or. Once again, Neon has scored, I guess. Yeah, yeah. Good for them. I mean, this is I think it's a great movie. It's to me, it feels. Red Rocket felt a little bit more substantive into what it was trying to put across as far as like the guy as a stand-in for Trump, but also for Trump culture and stuff like that. And like trying to be a little understanding to that kind of character and what their life is like and not be totally like full on judgmental and therefore creating an uninteresting canvas.
Right.
This is this feels like a victory lap in a lot of ways.
Okay.
This feels like the one like where he's like, I know I'm this good. I can get away with some stuff and I can just let it free fly. It's one of the funniest movies I've seen in so long. Like I was the middle section of this movie is so fucking funny.
Okay.
And then, I found Red Rocket hilarious. So like
Rocket is very fun. Yes.
I think it's a really funny movie. And I think this is just as funny. Mikey Madison, I mean, the general story is a sex worker, a stripper primarily, but a sex worker, Mikey Madison.
May remember her from she was the second not Jack Quaid killer. I think she was actually the lead killer in the Scream 5.
She is indeed. Also from Pamela Adlon's great series, Better Things. She's the eldest daughter.
Oh, geez. You know, I never got around to that.
Really good. If you can, you know, look around the Louis C.K. involvement, you know, in some pockets.
Was he on it or was he just a producer?
I think he's also on it, at least in the first season he has. I think something happens with him. Regardless.
His character is jerking off in front of women without asking them.
He might be talking around that. I don't know. She's fantastic in this movie. As if you've been reading any of the coverage out of Cannes, it is exactly that good. She's incredible in this. And one night, she's asked by her boss to look after a bunch of very young Russian guys. One of them is this guy Yuri, and he ends up being the son of a classic Russian oligarch. One of those guys who just owns everything, has had money in oil like since he was 10. And it's about their like budding relationship, their romance, and then the aftermath of like his parents finding out that had happened. And it goes from a very interesting like buildup of like how much is she using him versus he using her kind of thing to a much more like madcap chase. Like there's a good 45 minutes where it's just a search for one of these characters. Everybody's just trying to find one of them. And it's that is the funniest part. That part will have you crying. I don't think what I wish I had gotten a little bit more of was her alone. This is usually what I'm usually missing from movies where I'm just a little bit unsure of how great it is because I do wish I had like more time alone with her. The whole point is that she is with this guy essentially 15 minutes in on. She is with this guy. But like you don't get to exactly like Rex.
Simon Rex.
Simon Rex's character in Red Rocket. You did get these moments of pause alone where you kind of got to ruminate on what's going on inside. Like, what is he like away from all of this on his own? And I don't think you get quite as much in this one that you get in that one. But otherwise, as far as like a depiction of like, I think it was Texas in Red Rocket.
Yes.
It's such a, one thing I really got to give Baker, he does cities so fucking well. Like settings, places, you know, these places, these don't feel fake. These don't feel like, like a bunch of like a composite. It doesn't feel like we're trying to just create what a city would look like. It feels like the Florida Project feels like Florida. Red Rocket feels like
Texas.
This
dude, Florida like Project specifically, like you can fucking smell the Florida coming off that movie.
I have nothing but good things to say about this movie. I was just very happy with it from beginning to end.
That's really good to hear because I got nothing but you know positive vibes for Mikey Madison and Sean Baker. I will be seeing this. This is a New York Film Festival selection also. So I'll be seeing it in a couple of weeks. How are you feeling that runtime? Because if I have to slam Red Rocket for something, that movie's just too darn long.
I mean, it's depending on where you, like, I think, like, Red Rocket, to me, it earns that. Like, I never felt a moment where we were talking a lot about, like, the feeling of when you're watching a movie and you think it's about to end, or where you think there's this image that should be the end point, the period, or the exclamation part, whatever.
Yeah.
And I with smaller and genre movies specifically, I definitely feel that. But with things like this, I don't think about that so much. I'm kind of, because he anchors it so much to his central character, I really am just following them. So I never felt it that in this one. And I don't think I felt it in Red Rocket. I actually did feel it in Florida Project.
Oh, that's funny. See, I'm the opposite. I felt it in Red Rocket, but Florida Project, I was just kind of like in it the whole time. So I didn't notice as much.
Great movies still. I mean, they're all of them are great movies, I think.
This is out in limited release from Neon on October 18th. They will, of course, expand this. This will be end of the year contender stuff.
Oh, yeah.
For sure. Let me ask you this, just to put a cap on Anora. Someone here, let me just find it real quick. Ryan in the chat says, sounds like a modern Pretty Woman. How do you feel about that comparison?
I mean, it's if anything, it's kind of a deconstruction of that. I can kind of see where you're going with it. Pretty Woman to me is not funny. Like it's supposed to be, but I don't find it particularly funny in any real way. And like that movie is way more, class is an element to this for sure. And, but it's more, it's not as pronounced. It's as in Pretty Woman. Like Pretty Woman, it's like, we're about class here. This is what this is about. And like, it's woven into the fabric of it, and it feels more human that way. Like Richard Gere and Julia Roberts feel just like symbols of each class and what they're dealing with. They don't really feel like characters that are worn in any way. That's the thing with Baker, is that he does do absolute insane work with his actors, and they feel so grounded and so enmeshed with the character that's been written for them. And it always feels real. I mean, that's been true since like Takeout and Tangerine. Like, it's just they always feel natural.
Speaking of Pretty Woman, by the way, Boston, Massachusetts, December 4th.
Yes.
It's a Wednesday night. We'll be back at Laugh Boston to talk about that very movie. So that's going to be a lot of fun. Head over to our website and get them ticks.
We will be having Andrew sing his rendition of The King of Wishful Thinking, which is the the song that opens the beautiful Pretty Woman.
no promises there. We'll see how much beer I have in the green room beforehand. All right, switching gears a little bit. This is one that I caught, and I was kind of hesitant. Seems a little too strong. I was cautiously optimistic, and turned out to be pleasantly surprised. It's the new one from Mike Flanagan. The Life of Chuck is the motion picture with our beautiful boy there.
Hiddleston,
Mr. Hiddleston. So this is, it's interesting because not only is it a gear shift for Mike Flanagan, it's a gear shift for the author of the book that this movie is based on, Mr. Stephen King. Because in spite of having like a little bit of, paranormal is the wrong thing, but like a fantastical kind of vibe at parts, this is very much not a horror thing. It's not scary. It's just actually quite beautiful. You know, it is about, yes, this guy Chuck, Chuck Kranz, and his life in three stages of his life, basically. So the movie is it's basically a triptych, kind of told out of order. And it is just this, it's this really, I mean, I wonder how larger audiences will react to it, because I feel like, you know, one could make the argument that it's too saccharine kind of thing. I don't agree with that at all. I found it very like life affirming. It made me kind of like take a step back and just sort of like look at everything around. And it just sort of makes you like appreciate being on Earth and like being lucky enough to exist. I mean, I know that sounds so hyperbolic and crazy, but like that is how I felt about it. And, you know, you have these amazing touching performances from all these people. Some of the Flanagan stable pops in. You have Rahul Koji there. He's got a teeny tiny little role. I can't remember the woman's name. The woman from Black Mass, who's like the real crazy religious woman. She was one of the sisters in the last TV show he did there, the Poe one. House of Usher.
And
so like they do come in here and there. Kate Siegel, of course, comes in.
Sure.
She's got a scene. But it's actually really fascinating. You got like Chiwetel Ejiofor floating around in this movie, who's really great. Hiddleston himself is really touching. Karen Gillan from Guardians of the Galaxy and other things is also in it. And it's just this, you know, it's Stephen King-y in that way that like you're talking about a guy's life and it's like him as a kid and, you know, sort of like looking back on childhood sort of stuff. So like Stand By Me is kind of invoked in that way a little bit.
Okay.
But it is just this like such a sweet kind of thing. On the performances, what I wanted to say, though, out of all these great turns and these really nice sort of touching performances from people, Mark the Goat Hamill, dude. He plays Chuck's grandfather film. And he is just spectacular. He's just absolutely spectacular. And like, you know, I think so much of the time we think of Hamill, we think about like obviously Joker and Luke Skywalker, and then like all of the kind of ways he sort of made himself like this comedic persona now in modern times, which is great. I mean, I fucking love
He just seems to be having fun. Nice.
And this is like a real deal acting thing on top of his great ability to create a character. Like you're looking at this guy and you're like, all right, it looks enough like Mark Hamill, but he's aged up. He doesn't sound like Mark Hamill. He doesn't walk like Mark Hamill. He doesn't have Mark Hamill's gestures. You know, like it's a real deal fucking character who is present for a large portion of the movie. So like hats off to Hamill, man. And, you know, Flanagan, I think he avoids, for the most part, his biggest trap, which is just the monologizing out the ass. Like, there's a couple of those here in this movie, but they're reined in. You know, we're making a movie here. We don't have fucking 8 episodes to just flap our gums. Everything's kind of like reined in. But I found it all very genuine. It doesn't feel like phony, saccharine nonsense. It's a really, really interesting turn for both Stephen King and Mike Flanagan, honestly. And at the same time, it's also not. Like, you watch it and you can pick out, like, so much of the script is just, it sounds like Stephen King's dialogue sounds. The names of characters are very Stephen King.
Mm-hmm.
The way they talk, very Stephen King, you know? And then for Flanagan's side of it, the way he makes movies and the way he directs actors and the way he handles any kind of subject matter in all of his like previous horror things, that's all still totally in play. So it's really interesting to see these two guys change it up, do something totally unexpected, and have both of them, I think, like totally hit it out of the park. The crazy thing to me is that this doesn't have distribution yet. I guess Flanagan's deal with Netflix is TV only. Because I think this is his first feature since Dr. Sleep, which obviously was put out by Warner Brothers. So I don't know where this is going to land yet, but, you know, folks at home, definitely keep your eyes peeled for something a little different and not quite what you'd expect from two, you know, known names from horror.
I forget if, I mean, I don't think Dr. Sleep didn't do too well in the theater, like famously, right? It kind of did.
I don't remember, but I don't think it was great. I mean, it's very long and yada.
Because, yeah. I mean, it would make sense to, I mean, although now that I say that, now I'm thinking about it, I was going to say, like, you could just throw this to Max, but, like, they haven't been really on that for a while. They haven't been doing stuff like that. They seem to be more focused on the TV element and the episodic stuff now. I mean, I'll say I'm it's not surprising to me that Flanagan would make a sweet movie, because I think a lot of his shows do have an underlying sweetness to them. The Haunting, both the Haunting series, I think both have a sweetness to them. His movies less so, actually, now that I think about it. Although
the movies less so,
The Ouija and the Dr. Sleep, which are the two I like by him, they both have elements of like the family being like the unit that matters, and like that connection being matter, and trying to do that organically rather than just be like family good, like, you know,
which is funny because I think it totally works in Dr. Sleep. I think that's a fantastic movie. And I think it works in this movie. The funny thing is, I don't think it works as well in some of those TV projects. And I feel like when too much of that stuff is dumped on you, and like the last episode or the penultimate episodes of those series, you're like, I get it, man, the power of love. But boy, was that clunkily just dropped in here. This is like, it's more spread out. It's even paced. It starts and you fucking have no idea what's going on. And it's a really fascinating way that he structures the movie too. And I don't know if the story is structured the same way. I would imagine it is, just because it's King. But anyway, it's a big recommend from me. So we'll keep going here. This one coming up, it's another New York Film Festival entry as well. It is also coming out later this year from A24. It is On Becoming a Guinea Fowl from Rangano Nione.
Yep.
Comes out 12/13 in limited release from our friends at A24.
This is one of two movies I am going to wink wink call party movies. movies that really put you in the party spirit. And by that I mean torture you just a little bit. it's about a Zambian woman who is she's driving down the road one night. She's got the picture you see, that's the opening shot. And she is driving.
Oh, this is her
in the car.
I love this, whatever she's got on her head here with the sunglasses. And I'll have to see the movie.
Everybody has like party mask kind of thing going.
Okay. Oh, got it.
She has also like a Missy Elliott suit under, you can't see it, but that's what she's got there. She stops in the middle of the road. There's a body. It ends up being the body of her uncle. And the rest of the movie is essentially them figuring out how, like, what his funeral is going to be like, getting everybody together for the passing, all that. And there are revelations that come about exactly what Unc was up to, what he was, if maybe he was not such a great guy. And it deals a lot with the culture, especially with the misogyny in Zambia, where, like, with this thing, women take a lot of the fault for things. They have to take care of when someone dies, even if they don't like them, they have to make sure people have places to sleep. They have to make sure that people are being fed. They have to make sure, like, there are family members coming from everywhere to come to this place. And everybody, if it's a men especially, they have to be fed. They have to be housed. They have to be taken care of. And that, plus dealing with all the internal stuff, is really the drama of the movie. It is the second movie by Naomi. She did this great movie called I Am Not a Witch.
That's this director?
Yeah,
that's
the same director.
Ooh, I Am Not a Witch. Primo really recommend, man. Fantastic film.
Really, really good movie. I do think that is a better movie, but this is trying to get something darker, a little bit more, similarly fantastical, but in a realistic sense. Mm-hmm. I think it ends a little flatly, but up until then I was really with it. And even the ending, I get the meaning of it. There's a point to it. It just kind of, it felt like it was building to something, and then it took the, not an easier route, but a quieter route. Similar to, if anybody's seen, Rebel Ridge, recently.
Oh, dude, that's on the to-do list, man. I'm so excited for that movie.
You're gonna really like it. But like, similarly, like, you're expecting a big explosion, and like, you get something like that, but you don't get the big blood and guts. You don't get the rage and anything. It's a quieter movie, and I think it's better for it. I'm shocked A24 is putting out. It has certain similarities with the, I'm sure everybody's been hearing about the A24 house style for a couple of years now. It doesn't quite have that flavor to it. There are shots that do, but overall I didn't feel it really. There is one very particular, like, cut into a zoom already happening, which is a very big Ari Aster thing.
Let me ask you this though, just as far as the A24 acquisition, because, you know, reading about the movie and everything, and now hearing you talk about it a little more too, I wonder, do you think this is the annual, like, A24 super art house flick that we're given a leg up to, much as the way they did All Dirt Roads Taste of Salt last year, which, you, if you haven't seen that, magnificent movie, IMO. But it always appears like A24 has like that one movie each year where, you know, they will put it out and it's way more on like the art side of things and kind of not that A24 movie. We're putting shit on a fucking t-shirt and a tote bag kind of thing.
That may be the thought process. It's not like the subject matter and its political concerns are certainly things that A24 movies tend to circle back to, or a certain portion of them. I will say the big difference to me is that like All Dirt Roads Taste of Salt is a much more experimental film in form, like the way that movie unfolds. This is very easy to follow. It's more or less linear. There are some little jumpy things about flashbacks and visions and stuff like that. But for the most part, it is a linear story being told one after the other. I think it's definitely worth seeing. It's got, the lead is fantastic. I'm blanking on the name here. But I'm also just happy that Ringano Nioni is still making movies. Like, I wasn't sure if that was going to happen because I Am Not a Witch got a lot of attention, but it's not like it made money or anything.
No, and this movie's at a much bigger distributor.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Oh, I forget. Was it like Cinema Guild or somebody who had IMO?
I want to say it was Film Movement. And no shade to those guys. No. They put out really great essential shit. They just, their footprint is a little smaller.
New York, Chicago, and L.A. That's those places.
Yeah. So we'll move it right along here. Jeez, we're almost at 12:30. Can't even believe it. Next one up is another one that I caught, and it was one of two movies dealing with procreation and just human existence on Earth in a pseudo post-apocalyptic type thing. One much better than the other one, and we will start with the much better one first. It's a film called The Assessment by first-time filmmaker Fleur Fortuné is the director. And this, I was very displeased to find out this morning, is apparently going to Amazon Prime next year. And I sincerely hope that they do some kind of theatrical thing with it, because I feel like there is a big difference seeing a film like this on a big screen versus like shit you would just watch on TV. And I think if you just watch this on TV, it cheapens the experience for you a little bit. But it is a film about a couple in a post-apocalyptic kind of world. There's been, you know, an environmental cataclysm of some kind. And one of the things that is very much regulated with people living under a dome where the environment is still okay versus outside the dome where it is not, supposedly. That's part of the movie. So the amount of people that can have a child is regulated by the government in a way where you have an assessor come to your house and spend a week with you. That's the premise of the movie.
Okay.
The very flat kind of cannot describe to you the fucked up ways this movie goes, sort of flat description of the movie, because this thing goes places, baby. This shit is wild. So the couple is Elizabeth Olsen and Himesh Patel.
Oh, nice.
Loved seeing him in a cool movie like this, by the way. Like, I think that guy's great. He really turns on the chops here. Elizabeth Olsen is really great. So they're the couple. They want to have a baby. She is some sort of like botanist of some kind. And he is a guy that works on, it's not AI. It's like creating sort of, it's basically like he uses microcomputer kind of things, like nanotechnology kind of shit, to create life size and lifelike feeling pets for people in this world. They have decided all pets have to be eliminated. So Himesh Patel's job is making like animals that look and feel and sound like real animals. So that's what they're doing. The assessor, played by Alicia Vikander. Holy shit. I mean, the two of them are great as this couple. She comes in like a fucking weirdo tornado in the absolute best way. And when you see like her methods for this assessing, like boy, howdy, this movie is strange as fuck. I don't want to give too much away. Minnie Driver also comes in like a complete and total hurricane for one point. That's fantastic. It was a total surprise to me. It played really well. This was one of the few public screenings I went to. Played really well in the room, which was cool. But yeah, it was just, it's a really sort of, I'm a real sucker for this stuff. Sort of bare bones, minimal, but creative sci-fi in a film where like you're not inundated with bad CGI. We set up a very simple world and we know what the rules of the world are. And then like they, you know, she just puts these little touches on it, Fortuné does, like to make it, like the production design is really incredible to just look at. And like, it feels very real, even though it's a totally fake future world. So it's something where I don't want to give too much away, but boy, if you like getting down with strange stuff, man, this movie super goes places. And I was so thankful. I'm sitting there like, you know, the first weird moment comes and I'm like, oh, okay, that's cool. Neat enough. And then when you realize like it continues to escalate, I was like, oh boy, this movie's going for it. And that's why, again, like supremo bummer to see that Amazon is farting around with this movie, because this could have easily been IFC. This is something Neon could have done. I don't know how Amazon got their fucking ruddy little paws on it. But anyway, I guess you can see it, because, again, I don't know what they're going to do with this movie next year. It's a cool movie that I don't want people to forget about. And again, it's a nice reminder. Elizabeth Olsen. Yep, she does a good job with Scarlet Witch. No argument for me about that, but this is her really turning on the juice. It's probably the best she's been since Martha Marcy May Marlene. Can't believe I remembered that in the
there you go. I think you got it.
Which is a fabulous,
really good movie
from a cult movie. If people haven't seen that, but anyway, yeah, I can't really talk about it anymore because I don't want to give things away, because every little puzzle piece of it, I was like, well, good goddamn. But again, also, it was really cool seeing Alicia Vikander doing something that's, you know, worth watching.
I'm waiting for her to really break out again, because it's been a while since I've liked her in anything. Whereas like Elizabeth Olsen has, she seems pretty spiteful or at least indifferent to her Marvel stuff. Like whenever it is brought up, you can tell she's kind of like, well, fuck it. But yeah.
Please ask me about something else. Yes.
And like in the wake of doing all of that, I don't know, maybe she's doing more, who knows, but doing this, and then she's in the new Azazel Jacobs movies, which I've heard is very good.
His three daughters.
Yes. That's the one. I hear it's fantastic. And also she's doing the new Todd Solondz movie, which puts her in Valhalla.
Whoa, wait. Beep, beep, beep. Do the George Costanza.
Sure.
Solondz has a fucking movie in the hopper?
Solondz finally. Because it's been since Wiener Dog. I think Wiener Dog
was
it.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, I think shit. He's got, it's her and somebody else pretty big. Is the, like, maybe Hamish Linklater? Somebody of that kind of caliber.
Oh, okay. Oh, interesting.
But, I'm just so happy to see it. Like the way I was so happy to see like Pattinson after Twilight, just being like, I'll try weird stuff. I'll try like auteur. Yeah. I'll try doing that stuff. Like,
let's get down.
Be like, hey, let's have some fun.
By the way, also, I think more people need to see that Todd Solondz movie Wiener Dog, if only because I'm sick and tired of seeing screenshots of Danny DeVito in the movie, and it's being posted online, and it's like, here's Danny DeVito walking his tiny dog. Isn't that funny? I'm like, it's from a fucking movie from like 10 years ago, you jackass.
And he's really good in it. He's like really fucking good in it.
Anyway, look for the assessment. Write it down. Put it on your fucking Letterboxd watch list and just see what happens with it. So interesting thing here. We're going to shift gears just a tiny bit to cover something you saw from the festival's primetime selection. Yep. And primetime is where they cover TV stuff. So this is the new project from Janixa Bravo.
Yes.
Which is called The Listeners. And this is, I guess, airing on BBC One sometime this year. No word on what's happening stateside.
I would think eventually, usually a BBCer goes to...
It goes somewhere.
IFC is very good with bringing them over usually. I don't know if that's still... And sometimes FX also does some partnerships with them occasionally.
Well, didn't like Netflix do... eventually they wound up like playing Downton Abbey in some capacity. So like, I think it'll be over here some way, somehow, you know.
I would hope Bravo is a big enough name that you can get some, because it is an interesting, because I had never done this before, other than like, I showed up for like the first half of the screenings of the Steve McQueen Occupied City that ended up going to Amazon.
Oh, yeah.
But like, I don't usually go to see like pilots and stuff in it. So it was interesting to see how they presented it. And it was very much like the first time you're watching an episode of TV. I mean, essentially, the story is of a younger, middle-aged woman with a daughter and a husband. And she starts hearing these a noise. And it seems like the noise changes where she is. But she's the only one who can hear it. Her husband doesn't hear it. Her daughter doesn't hear it. None of her friends seem to hear it, except for one of the kids in her class does, the kind of troublemaker in her class, also hears it. Okay. And they start a relationship. It's definitely chased, and it's definitely there's something there, but they don't really press the sexual angle of it. They don't press the romantic angle of it, really. They seem to both just be dealing with this thing, and they start going to meetings with other people who also hear the noise.
This is interesting. Now you're grabbing me, TV show.
That's the general plot of it. It's Rebecca Hall, so like you're anchored. She's just incredible. Like, I could just watch her do anything. Movies I do not like, I watch all the way through because she's so good in them. And it's funny because it doesn't really have that much of a beefy supporting cast. Gail Rankin, I think, is one of the other people in the group. But I didn't really recognize many other people. It's good in that way because, again, it does like anchor the way it's like these are people who have specialty, and everything else is kind of moved to the side. So it's easier to kind of do that when you have Rebecca Hall as the main character, and like almost everybody around her is not, I mean, not bad actor, very good actors, but like not fucking like major actors like she is. It's not as it's certainly not as colorful and buoyant as something like Zola. Zola to me is like incredible the way that movie
Zola was her movie from a few years ago that was based off of an infamous Twitter thread. I mean, that's a movie, folks at home, get your buns to the VOD menu and find that. That's a, speaking of party movie, I mean, that's like and speaking of like Florida feeling real on screen, absolutely. Like Zola, primo flick. Anyway, sorry.
It's much more, it speaks to like the Englishness of it. It's a much more becalmed movie, show. The narrative is a lot more restrained. It's funny to me because moving from Lemon to Zola to this, there is a trying things here. Like each one is of its own self. It's not, the idea, like what she's concerned with is clearly similar in each one, but the story, how it unfolds, the style of it is different in all three, which attracts me. And I'm interested to see what she does next. I will be, whatever this gets picked up, I'll definitely be watching the rest of it. It's as a person who doesn't watch much TV anymore, it grabbed me, and it takes a lot for a pilot to grab me these days. That's 2 years of being at Collider and watching every single TV show that was coming out all the time kind of break me. So like, I only take in a little bit, but this is interesting enough to me.
I was looking on IMDb, and it appears, I mean, if that information is accurate, it's a 4-part series.
That makes sense.
You don't have too much longer to go, but at that like 80-ish minute runtime, that does sort of feel like Sherlock to me, speaking of like BBC things, you know, BBC. Where each segment's kind of a feature length, whatever.
What's funny is that we were working towards like trying to do like, because like something like House of Dragon, like you would think like it like every episode's a little over an hour, and you're like, well, if this is only 4 of these, maybe I would hang out. Like, maybe I would be able to handle this. But like, since you insist on it being like 8 to 10, and like, it just doesn't need that much. You're giving me too much. I'm not going to be able to eat all of this.
That's the thing, man. I really like it. I think it's probably the show with the best production design going right now. That LOTR, Rings of Power, like I've started that second season. every episode is like 70 minutes.
Oh,
and it's
really?
Just, it's so much. Jesus it's Christ. So much. So yeah. Anyway, so moving back to movies here, big time, big dog director here with his undistributed film at the festival.
Weird.
And I think this is very funny. With all of the stars and the gorgeous location that the film is photographed around,
yeah.
This is the promo shot that the festival was given by the film team to use for the movie.
Oh, Ronnie. That hi, Ron.
Kind of says a lot. This is Eden, the new one from, of course, Mr. Ron Howard. No distributor on this guy yet. His last movie, the Cave movie there with Viggo Mortensen and friends.
Amazoner, I think.
Amazoner with a barely theatrical footprint, fucking piece of shit Hillbilly Elegy was Netflix. So I don't know where this is going to wind up, but I will say someone should buy this and put it in a theater because the locations are exquisite. This is a really good looking movie. This is a narrative based on the same story that I saw a documentary on years ago. It's absolutely fascinating doc called The Galapagos Affair. So this movie also is the story of that, which is there was a German doctor, philosopher fella who kind of like had it with Germany in the late 1920s, moved he and
understandably
his wife,
understandably sure. I would say
yeah there was some bad stuff going around there. So he moves them to an island in the Galapagos where no one lives, and he gets like a sanction from the governor you know that oversees all of these territories in you know the Galapagos, and gets permission to move there and build a life for himself with his wife where they can sort of live in this pseudo utopia while he writes the great book that's going to change humanity, like real fucking delusional shit.
Sure.
So that is in this movie is played by Jude Law. He's the doctor. And Vanessa Kirby is the wife. So right there, the cast is awesome.
Yeah.
So the sort of the inciting incident of the story is they're living it up when all of a sudden a family lands on the island to move next to them. And that is, it's Sydney Sweeney and Daniel Brühl.
Oh,
sorry, okay. I've got like 15 movies in my head here.
Sure.
So Daniel Brühl and Sydney Sweeney, who I think, by the way, Sydney Sweeney doing pretty good in this movie.
Okay.
They move there with Daniel Brühl's child. It's not her kid. She's like the second wife because she's like 20 years younger than him or whatever. But okay. So they move there and it's like, howdy, neighbor. We're going to fucking build camp here too. You had a great idea. And so like, Jude Law and Vanessa Kirby are kind of like, great. And then what puts the whole thing over the edge is then who moves in is this baroness played by Ana de Armas, who comes in with like these two hunks of man on her arm and is going to build a hotel on the island.
Okay.
And so it's the story of these three groups of people trying to live together on this island. It plays like a total paranoid thriller, you know, as they try to like basically mess with one another and sabotage one another's experience on the island to get them to leave.
Mm-hmm.
So whoever is the last person standing, you know, Jude Law can finish writing the book, or you know, Daniel Brühl and his family can just be farming and, you know, raising their baby that's on the way. Or it can be the fucking, you know, the rich fucking lady socialite who wants to build this hotel. So it's all of this like sniping, super douche chill social moments and outright nefarious plotting against people. Mm. And I think it's Ron Howard's best movie since Cinderella Man, which is 18 years ago.
A long time.
I was in it, man. I was in this movie. It's so watchable. You know, and Howard, for what he is as a director, which is basically a dude that can do some interesting sequences, but really sort of direct actors. That's his strongest suit, IMO.
Mm-hmm.
The performances here are all really great. And it looks good enough, but it's a little dull. I mean, that's like kind of a lot of his stuff is like, it's very muted colors, and like you're in the jungle and you're on the beach in this movie, and it's like everything's just kind of muted down. That was sort of my biggest beef with it.
That's something where I think you really do need to finally sit down. I know it's long as shit, but you got to just sit down and watch 13 Lives because it is visually his most interesting movie by miles. Like, it's him working with Apichat Pong's guy, the guy from who did Trap just recently. I'm blanking on his name. He's an incredible DP. Them together, that really makes that movie come alive, and that really, that has a very unique look to it. Whereas, like, I do agree with you. He is so drab usually. Even Cinderella Man, which I do like, it's a little drab looking. It's just kind of
but
like
that movie. See, it's so funny though. But that movie, I think it's okay to look drab because it takes place during the Great Depression.
Sure.
So it's if there was ever a movie that should look like urine-soaked shit, right? By the way, Soyombu McDeepprom is the DP.
Yes, he's unbelievable, this guy. This guy is one of the best.
So, you know, I know on all our family of shows, you know, I give Howard a hard time. I think he's got a good one on his hands here. Mm-hmm. I hope a real company picks it up and puts it in theaters so people can experience this big, you know, outdoor island adventure, not on a television, but we will see. But yeah, great performances all around. I'm really excited to have people see it. Complete and total gear shift right now, Chris Cabin. Move over to something much smaller on your end. It's a film
party
called
movie.
April.
Party movie. Party movie. It's
Deo Kolombashvili's April is the
man,
film.
Man, oh fucking man. I mean, if anybody has seen her first movie, A Beginning, which is very good, you know what you're up for. This is as slow as it. This is like the ideal of like Eurocentric dramas, like post 70s, like long takes. Almost like all sound design, but very like wind through the trees and dripping water kind of sounds.
So like a cup of coffee with a couple of espresso shots before you go into the theater for this.
Oh man, if they do this in the morning, they're just being cruel. I mean, it's it's not that kind of. You need to have your phone. I watched this at like 8:30 and I was having trouble. It is good. Like that, I don't want that to shake that from the fact that it's a good movie. And it's very eerie. And it does speak to in a very similar way as on Becoming a Guinea Fowl. Talking about a misogynistic society where like it's about an abortion doctor. She has to go to villages. She has a stillbirth in the hospital she works with during during the day, and that leads to someone essentially letting it out that she performs abortions illegally in villages not even that close. There's this driving scene that goes on for like 10 minutes where it's just a
they
long
literally time. Put the camera in the car and they fucking drove to the next place.
I'm not kidding you.
I love that shit, man. I totally love it.
Like, it's very meditative. And like there's all these unbelievable, the lighting in this fucking movie is insane, but like and that's what I think really will draw people in, is the movie looks nuts. There are a lot more eerie notes to fantasy and self-imagery and dreaminess than Beginning. I mean, Beginning just looked really good. That this, the actual narrative is playing with that stuff as well. And I mean, dealing with a society where abortion is like seen like as murder, it's treated like that. They literally, people just call her murderer all day long. It's not a bunch. It's mostly her by herself, so you don't see too many other people. But again, a strong, like one of those movies, don't go into it expecting a good time. Don't go into it expecting a movie that's going to lift your spirits. This is, you know, there's a miserabilia thing to this, but also I think it's trying to get at the heart of a character that is tough. It's not one, you know, there's not many of these movies that do well. Like Vera Drake, I think, is the best of the bunch. And like, even that had to get a big push from like Focus and God knows whoever put it out. It was a Mike Lee movie.
Maybe Sony Classics. That doesn't matter.
It is something. But this, I think if you are into this kind of subject matter, and if you are into that, the naturalism. Like there's nothing faked here. It looks very realistic, and all the setups are very realistic. It does sink you into a very believable situation that is tense. But also there are some really beautiful moments, and there is one. David Ehrlich called it the skin monster. I don't know what else to call it. There is this creature in this movie.
Didn't expect this to be exactly about
like
right
there's, there's like these tiny little things that it does dollop throughout that give it this certain flavor that I don't think Beginning had. But yeah, worth seeing if you know what you're getting yourself into.
Just because I'm a nerd, I had to look it up. Vera Drake was originally Fine Line Features. It went to New Line, so it's a Warner Brothers movie now.
Oh, well, there you go.
So it sort of sounds like you're saying it's got a, maybe with the realism angle, bit of like a 4 months, 3 weeks, 2 days kind of a thing, like that sort of a vibe.
Even that, like to me, even the like, I don't know if it's just because of like the way that Romania is, like there's a color thing in 4 months, 3 weeks, and days that gives it a certain tint, like that is not necessarily realism. I don't know what to say of that. Like I haven't seen 4 months and 3 weeks and God knows, probably since New York Film
Festival. It's not really something one goes back to yearly.
I did see it twice. I saw it again, but
You really? Why did you? Why?
I saw if I had not seen it, and I thought it was a pretty. Sure. I really loved the movie, but it is. It is also much less dramatically. Active. Like there's just not that much talking in it. It's mostly there are questioning scenes, but it's mostly quiet scenes. And there's some that are so wildly uncomfortable and are going to like it, again, like it's one of those movies where you go in knowing the point of the director is to show you what this kind of work is like, what this kind of life is like. So you do see an abortion and you do see a live birth and like and it's not like a fake thing. She's not like cutting around it. There's a baby coming out of vagina. Like it's, and it's really striking and it's really strong, but it's certainly not going to be for everyone, I will tell you that.
Fair enough. All right, so moving on, this next one I'll go through really quick because I wasn't super crazy about it and I really don't want to be mean or anything. I mean, I wouldn't be mean about it, but I just it's a film called Can I Get a Witness? It's the new one from Anne-Marie Fleming, who is a sort of a multi-hyphenate visual artist, writer, animator, and filmmaker. And this is the other movie, when I was talking about the assessment, this is the other movie that deals in population control during pseudo post-apocalyptic times. The movie is about a world where overpopulation, they realize, was what was driving global warming and environmental collapse. And so the world decided, like on a, like a global agreement, to do a population control thing where this when a person gets to 50 years of age, they are forced to commit suicide. And it's sort of like a really uninteresting Logan's Run. Because I'll leave my criticism for a second, but it is about this young girl Kia, who is starting her first day of work as a witness. And so the agreement we have here is, now there are these jobs, it's a job position called a witness, and it's basically you're a two-person team of witnesses who goes to the house or wherever previously selected location for the person who has to commit suicide, and they come to bring the device that facilitates the suicide, make sure it happens. And Kia's job, because photographic equipment and the like, technology has been sort of outlawed, so she has to draw these people in their final moments for reason. It's a very sloppily set up world. So it's basically Kia as this, you know, sort of young, just starting her life, getting out into the world, sort of guarded kind of girl, is seeing like dead bodies for the first time and whatever. And she's partnered with this sort of younger hunky guy, or older hunky guy rather. I mean, he's still a young guy, but he's older than her. And they go around and you see them like go to these appointments. And what drove me nuts about the movie, and I think Jamie from Sleazoids was in the screening with me, and we were talking about this afterwards, but like, no one in the movie really has a problem with the way the society is set up. Like, everybody just kind of goes along with it. Anytime the movie reaches a character that like may have a problem with what they're about to do or what they're about to watch someone else do, the tide kind of just goes back into the ocean and no one like gives a shit again. You know what I mean? So it's like, you expect in a movie, like a story like this, there's going to be an opposition front. There's going to be someone that this protagonist who is having these doubts herself is going to meet, and it's like, oh, there are like-minded people that also had these doubts about this globally agreed upon system. You know, they have the same doubts about it as I do. Let's explore that a little more.
Mm-hmm.
It just doesn't do that. It's just this really bizarre, like, doormat of a concept where everybody's just like, them's the breaks. Mm-hmm. And so, like, her mother is played by Sandra Oh, and she spends the movie basically in scenes just by herself while the daughter character goes out and makes these appointments or whatever. She's basically preparing for her own suicide. That's how she spends the mm-hmm. movie. And it's just this like, we gotta do it for the planet. And there's no like, for as much as the movie is just dumping dump truckload after dump truckload of exposition back on this protagonist as if she's the dumbest person to have ever lived, right? Mm. It's like the movie doesn't trust itself. It doesn't trust the audience's intelligence. And you're watching this movie and it's just basically re-explaining the concept of the movie to this character. And I'm like, she knows. She lives in the world. And we got it. You told us four times already. Like, it's one of those movies where it's explaining the concept of the movie still in like the last 10 minutes of the movie. Yeah. And I just felt it had nothing to say about actual overpopulation and environmental collapse and all that stuff. That was all just like lipstick on a pig for this just really bad suicide pack pseudo sci-fi. Again, lazy Logan's Run. At least in Logan's Run, people got a fucking problem with it. They go on the run.
Yeah.
And this is just like, boop. You know, it's just shoulder shrug the motion picture. And I just thought it was a complete failure. I mean, and the other thing too is the copy talks about like, oh, it's this, you know, cause she's an animator, right? You know, Fleming is an animator, and it's like, there's all, you know, it's a live action movie, but it's just peppered with all this great animation. And like, they kind of just give up on that about like halfway through the movie. And then it kind of comes up here and there again. But I'm like, if you're going to do something like that, and the animation is great, it's very striking. I mean, if you look here, the still is, he is drawing a dude who's about to commit suicide and these animated ducks fly by.
Mm.
It's really nice. And the animation is beautiful. And there's just like not enough of it. And I was like, did you get bored of this idea, you know, in post-production or something? And you just didn't want to do it? Or did like a resource thing happen? I don't know. But I was like really wanting more of that animation too, because I thought it was really gorgeous looking and there's just not enough of it. We got two more here. So I'm just going to blabber through the next one here, because now the only one left that you've seen is Night Bitch at the end. But I did want to bring up, I think, gee, you know, the more that I sit on it, I think this is probably the best thing I saw at the festival. It's the new one from Gia Coppola, The Last Showgirl. Now, this is you may have heard some rumblings about this. It's Pamela Anderson in this movie playing the titular Last Showgirl. She plays a woman who has been in the same Vegas Strip, you know, casino show for 30 years. And the announcement comes down by club technician manager Dave Bautista, who's fantastic in the movie, that the show's closing.
Mm-hmm.
And so the whole movie is Pam Anderson's character being like, well, shit, this is all I've ever done. You know, I'm in my 50s now. Our society is as such where like now she's just deemed garbage to be thrown on, you know, the waste bin of society, you know, because she's old and in this kind of business. So it's her grappling with that along with her team of friends in the showgirl thing, the act, retired showgirl who's now a cocktail waitress at a casino, played by a fabulous Jamie Lee Curtis.
Hmm.
And then Kiernan Shipka is like the young girl just getting on the scene, you know, who's sort of like learning the hard way that she can't go back to her family that she's got strife with or whatever. And then one other actress, I can't remember, but there's like a little family kind of unit. And then Dave Bautista is the guy who manages them. And he's like actually a sweet dude. And so it's like just it's mainly Pam Anderson. And she's like grappling with this. She's got a dirter that she doesn't see too much, you know, because of the show and everything. And it is just it's a beautifully shot movie. I think Gia Coppola did a really good job. She does lean a little too much into the indie trope of like, the camera's hovering right around her face while we watch her think, you know, and like that kind of stuff. It eventually sort of settled down as far as that goes. So the habit was kind of broken, but I was sitting there like, all right, can we get a fucking medium shot here? Or, you know, heaven forbid, maybe a wide every once in a blue moon. I mean, variety. We're in Vegas. Yeah. Like we're in Vegas for Christ's sakes. Like I want to see Vegas, you know?
Yeah.
But boy, it is a special movie, and she's really great in it. Pamela Anderson is so good in this movie. Like, it is not only a career high for her, but this is a career redefining role for her. I mean, it's unbelievable the performance that she gives and that Gia Coppola gets out of her. And Jamie Lee Curtis, too. Like, the both of them are just absolutely fucking fearless in this movie. And I, you know, going into it, like, reading the description, you know, I will admit I was a little cynical. The only other movie of Gia's I've seen is Palo Alto, which I wasn't crazy about. And so I was kind of like, okay. And then like after I came out, I was like, boy, howdy. I was wrong to have low expectations for this. Primo stuff. Primo scuzzy guy, Vegas guy haircut on Dave Bautista, by the way. Also primo scumbag 11th hour cameo from Jason Schwartzman.
Yeah,
which is also nice. But oddly enough, I was reading because I'm like, how does nobody have this movie? And I remembered at the start of it, the Utopia logo comes up. Utopia, I guess, is only functioning as the sales agent for it. And I'm like, Utopia, like, just put it out. Like, put it out yourselves. Make it one of your movies. And, you know, maybe they will and maybe they have. But just really, really special, great, you know, low budget, good looking, interesting kind of movie. I really, really, really liked it. So here we go. Final thing of our TIFF coverage from this year. And again, thanks for everybody for tuning in and, you know, re-downloading this on the feed. You know, we will be doing New York Film Festival coverage in a couple weeks. So stay tuned for that as well on both YouTube and Twitch and on the podcast feed. But anyway, so the new one from Mario Heller, director of other movies we've liked more, I think. Night Bitch, the new one here with Amy Adams from Searchlight Pictures, coming out in limited release this December. So clearly Searchlight is confident enough in this movie to position it as an end of year awards rollout.
Well, Amy Adams is in it. It has to be an awards contender, doesn't it? It has to be that way. That is what we are doing now.
Yeah, it's kind of strange. I mean, I think, and I'll you know, sort of tamper expectations here. Like, I didn't hate this movie, but I just think it's, again, something I've seen too often, which is a good Amy Adams performance inside a movie that's just kind of like not doing her any justice.
No, and I mean the general idea is it's a woman dealing with her a child. I mean, the kid's but like what, but 2 years old, it looks like, kind of
something like that
around there. And dealing
he's
with,
he's talking a lot and stuff like that.
It feels like a terrible twos kind of movie. But it's just that dealing with that end of marriage and having an awakening sort of brought on by a mystical book she finds in a library.
Given to her by Jessica Harper of Suspiria fame.
Which was very, it's nice to see her, honestly.
Yeah, I'm happy she's working. It was cool to see her pop up in a movie.
And, you know, I think the problem here is that, I mean, we were talking about this right before we had to leave. And I think there's not many movies made about, like, being pregnant and then, like, what that means to the body and what that means to the... Horror has tried to do this more often and made it a horrific thing. And it's more difficult to make a positive vision of it, even if it's a complicated vision. And that's what I think Heller was trying to do with Adams here. And it just it goes south. Like there's too many things being trying to be done at the same time. Yeah. It is very female centric. So like when for the first half of the movie, Scoot McNairy as the husband is very much a sideline character. He's mostly for punchlines. It's very much like, oh, hey, what do you mean? You can't, can you tell me how to do a diaper? I don't know. Like,
because it's a lot of this movie's vibe is that kind of like, isn't this all crazy and wild mommy blogger kind of vibe to it, you know?
Yeah. And like, oh, my shitty husband who needs help with everything. And like, yep. To a degree, if it had stayed that way, if Scoot McNairy had continued to be a sideline joke, it might have worked, or at least it might have cohered a little bit more at the end. But once you start making about halfway through, or about like an hour in, maybe even, they try to make him a character.
Yes.
And the element, what you're trying to show in the first is like a woman who's trying to claw her way back to like an individuality, like having her own self again and having her own release from before she was a mother, like separating herself from the child a little bit every once in a while. And eventually you can see she's trying to say like, well, men have to do this too. Like women are forced to do it themselves in a way because like they house the child, like they are already connected to the child from the beginning. Men don't have to go through that by nature or by organic process. They have to like force themselves to do it. And like what this movie is arguing is that you should do that. But the problem is that once Scoot McNairy begins to become a character, they kind of don't know what to do with him. Like the movie, unless you're going to add another hour to the movie and make it about both of them, like then maybe it works because then you get to see whatever process he has to go through. But it is the genre element of her becoming a dog because of her motherly feelings and all these emotions and things she's going through and the tearing between like individuality and becoming a family person. Like that element, if you want to push it towards the horrific, I certainly would have connected it with it more. Would other people? I don't know. But like,
if you do that, though, it fundamentally shifts the kind of movie you're making. And
it's no longer a positive or even an insightful attempt to explain motherhood in some way. It's not can't do both at the same time. Honestly, maybe you could, but it's certainly not what they're up to here. That's not what their end game here is. And like the transformation scenes you get are very kind of like, oh. Okay, like it's not bad. It's not necessarily bad. It just kind of is like, oh, I'm indifferent to that. It happened. That sure happened.
Yes, and it's weird because that's the kind of stuff that they're selling the movie on. And I mean, that's not the film's fault, but that's just like what the copy reads about. And that's, you know, when you look at like, I'm sure the trailer will lean into that, right? Mm-hmm. My beef with that, though, because I think you know, yes, like I said, if you lean into the body horror more so than this movie does and all that stuff, you do fundamentally change the DNA of the movie. And so I'm not saying it should have done that necessarily, but my thing I couldn't get over in the movie is there are times in the movie where it feels like they are saying this stuff is all in her head.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's other times in the movie where it very much confirms that, yeah, she's turning into a dog.
Mm-hmm.
But so it goes, it tries to do both of them at the same time, I felt. And I was like, this is distracting me because now you're watching the movie and you're asking stuff like, well, she just said to Scoot McNairy, hey, now I have 8 nipples. And Scoot McNairy then just saw her naked in the shower. And doesn't notice that. And like, I guess you can put that on like, oh, he's the clueless husband. But like, nah, I saw those extra nipples in the, when she's got the makeup on or whatever, like you'd notice it. And so it was distracting to me that I felt like the movie didn't make a decision on all that. And the way, and it's not just like that. It's just like the way the characters react to things she's saying, because the movie definitely does a mix of, you know, like Scoot McNairy says something at one point and she slaps him in the face and you're like, whoa. And then, it turned out she just imagined that.
Yeah, yeah.
But then there's other parts where, like, she's actually saying and doing things. And again, I'm like, oh, is this like when you slap Scoot McNairy? Oh, no, that actually happened. And I felt like it was too back and forth with that. And I was like, you got to land on either people are noticing the shit and you're talking about it more in the movie, or it's way more of a metaphorical thing. Because they also try, like, she's having these flashbacks to, like, her mother when, you know, like, the Amy Adams character was a child and she inherited this from the mother. And I get like on the allegory side what you're talking about inheriting there, but the way you're showing these flashbacks and the mother's also turning into a dog, it's like you're leaning into that genre thing without confirming that that stuff's actually happening all the time. So I just found that a bit wishy-washy. I did think, you know, Amy's good for what it is. It's just, it didn't work for me. I will say, though, boy, howdy, it is 98 minutes of pure uncut grade A birth control. Holy Christ almighty. If I did not have any interest in that shit before, I certainly do not after watching Night Bitch. That's a certainty. But yeah, so, you know, we'll see. I don't know if Searchlight has another huge hit on their hands like they had last year with the Yorgos picture. The name of which escapes me. What the fuck was that called? Yorgos Lanthimos, Emma Stone.
Oh, of what the fuck?
Defoe.
Yeah. Oh, Poor Things.
There we go. Yeah, I mean, Poor Things was their big movie last year, so I don't know if this will reach that. But hey, you know, limited release. I'm not saying don't check it out. I want people to see it and see, you know, where do you land on this? Like, does that bother you? Because the wishy-washiness of it really truly bothered me.
The wishy-washiness, like, I'm at least in the first like brush of it, I'm at least willing to excuse it as this is her mental state collapsing. You don't know what she means, what she doesn't mean, what she's thinking out loud, what she's keeping to herself, imagining. I'm okay with that at first, but like eventually you never push. If that is going to continue, you also have to make her crazier, and like her becoming crazier is like eating meatloaf without hands and like rolling around in the dirt with her kid, like, which are pretty normal mom thing. Like, say what you will about eating without the hands. Yeah, okay, it's a little silly, but it's not something out of the fucking realm of possibility when you're having goof offs with your kid. That certainly isn't, to me at least.
Right.
And like, so again, like, if you push the body horror, if you push any part of the horror, like, she kills an animal at one point, and again, you don't really know if she did it or you didn't. But if you had taken those things a little bit more seriously, if you had think about the mortal and moral consequences of such things a little bit more seriously, maybe you get something out of this, and maybe you find the heart of this idea. The way, to be clear, she did very easily in both Can You Ever Forgive Me and A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, which I think is fantastic.
Great movie.
This one, I just was like, I needed this to go somewhere else. And there were like five things on the list, and she was like, let's do all of them. And it just left me kind of being like, well, whatever, man. Like, cool. Amy Adams, again, like with all of these fucking movies that she puts out, she's good again. But like all the other stuff, I'm just like, I don't care about this movie. I haven't cared about her movies since like Arrival, probably.
Yeah. I mean, that's the last one that I was really like, fuck yeah.
Yeah, that's great.
You know what I mean?
Good job.
So, you know, who knows? We'll see what other people think, but that was just our vibe on it. I will say, this was another one I was at a public screening for. It played incredibly well. I knew watching it that people in the room were enjoying it much more than I was, which is fine. That's the fun of all this. Speaking of the fun of all this, I do want to, because you kicked in some shekels here to make a highlighted comment, so I want to give the fellas money's worth here, but Barnaby Jones just says, I tend to pass up on screens to avoid spoilers, which, by the way, Barnaby, first of all, we do go out of our way to avoid spoilers on Screen Live proper, so that's, put that out there. But they say, I'll be damned if they don't have four or five new movies on the radar now. Well, that's exactly why we're doing this, Barnaby, so thank you for bringing that up. It's one of the fun things about covering film festivals like this is getting the audience hip to stuff in advance, so you can, you know, be aware of stuff as it comes out, because as we say here all the time, that fucking movie pipeline, man, is constantly clogged with stuff, and we're just here to help you maybe sift through a little bit of it. So that's gonna do it for our 2024 Toronto coverage. Chris, this was a lot of fun, man, and I can't wait to do it next year with you, and hopefully other dudes can come from the show as well this time next year. But that's going to do it. Stay tuned to the socials and everything, by the way, for when OSL comes back proper, but also when we announce the coverage of when we're going to do New York Film Festival stuff, because it'll probably be like this, some off days, not necessarily Mondays at noon. So just be aware of all that. And that's about it. Remember, of course, like and subscribe to the channel, like this video, get those notifications. We like hanging out with you guys. So thanks for tuning in. And until next time, I have been Andrew Jupin.
Chris Cabin.
Take it easy, y'all. Bye-bye. Have a good weekend.